supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, one of the most enchanting winter plants you're likely to ever see, Pyracantha, otherwise known as firethorn, with all those colorful berries. We're going to tell you how to improve the berry production on your firethorn. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Laura, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you, Mike. Thank you so much for taking my call. It's just sort of dumb luck that I stumbled upon your radio program last week.
Well, I've lived by dumb luck for almost 62 years so far, Laura. It's never let me down. Where are you?
I'm in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm shocked that it took you long to find us. That is a hardcore group of listeners out there, just next to Dayton, right?
Right, right. I actually moved here about a year ago, so just kind of finding out the area.
We get so many calls and so many emails. I think I can even tell you it's WYSO?
Yes.
Yes. We love being on the air out there.
So my question is, I don't know really the first thing about plants and anything that I've ever had. It's just their willingness to survive, the only reason they've lived. I have a 4.5-year-old granddaughter, and sometime late last winter, very early spring, I was eating an apple, and she noticed the seeds in them. And we decided we were going to grow the seeds, knowing nothing about this. We took all the seeds out, and we put them in an egg carton and filled it up with some potting soil that I had sitting around for I don't know how long. And it took about 6 weeks. And we got a growing lamp, and they started to grow. And I asked somebody what I was supposed to do with them when they got about 4 inches long, and they told me to transfer them into another pot and put them outside and keep them in a pot for about a year and then plant them out and protect them from deer. And so they were doing pretty good over the summer, and then I brought them in when I was afraid that the frost would get them, and now it seems like they're starting to not look so good. So the leaves, they're starting to get this white powdery stuff on
mm-hmm.
them, and
yeah.
The leaves are starting to get like they're dying off on the top.
Yeah.
I guess like what would be the trunk or the main stem, they're not very thick. They look kind of fragile, and they just seem to be not thriving anymore.
Apples need a chilling period. Apples, peaches, pears, all of these kind of stone fruits, seed fruits, they have a certain requirement to be outside in cold temperatures for X hundred number of hours, temperatures below 45 degrees. So the apple, I have never heard of an apple being successfully grown indoors because you would have to almost like put it in a fridge for 3 or 4 months or something like that. The tall and skinniness shows that it's not getting enough light. And the white stuff is some sort of insect. Now, you got pretty good advice from the person who told you to take your little baby starts and pot them up. If you want to do this for real, just a simple shop light, 2 4-foot-long fluorescent tubes with the plants kept up close to the cool tubes, that'll help you grow lots of plants. But what I would do is I would take another apple. And this time, instead of egg cartons, I would start with little plastic pots filled with potting soil. And I would get started on apples that we could put outside next year, 2014. So What I would suggest you do, you know, because you obviously already germinated them well, keep those pots with the seeds in them in a warm spot. Put more than one seed per pot. When they come up, clip off all the ones except the one that you like the best, and then put them under that plant light until we get to springtime. And then take them outside. And just for safety's sake, there's no reason to have to grow them above ground. Dig the little holes, drop the pots into the ground. But this is just going to be temporary. And make sure you protect them from deer and rabbits. And then maybe at the end of the season, you pot them up into the next bigger pot. But then you do the same thing. You would drop the pot into a hole in the ground, perhaps in a sheltered area for the winter. So it would be outside with its roots underneath the soil line, but exposed to the cold weather. And then the following season, you would take that out of its pot after it had finished blooming and everything. You'd probably get a couple of flowers by then. And find a permanent location for it, and you'll get a real tree.
Okay. And so you don't think that the chance of bees surviving is very good?
I don't think they'll be very healthy trees, but if you want to try it, you would harden them off. You would take them out for a couple of hours a day progressively. Keep them in the coolest place in your house otherwise, and see if they can get adjusted to the season. But I'm afraid they've kind of missed the natural cycle. They should have been asleep by now, long ago. Nobody has success with anything the first time.
I'll try that. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Laura.
I've learned a lot. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Brian, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, happy to be on the show. Long-time listener, first-time caller. How are you?
I am great, Brian. Thank you very much. Where are you, man?
I am in Kutztown, Pennsylvania, just down the road from the college.
Oh, yeah, Kutztown. Ring baloney once, ring baloney twice. Kutztown. Ain't that nice? That is your school song, isn't it? Yeah.
Something like that. Generally, I was expecting to hear the clip-clop of hooves in the background.
What can we do for you?
Well, I had purchased a jade plant from one of our, let's just call them a big box retailer,
sure,
home improvement store, mm-hmm, and bought it about 10 years ago when I was going to school in Kutztown, coincidentally, and did just let it grow. I had a little balcony, set it up there, and it thrived. It did really well. I would bring it in for winters, of course. Transplanted it a couple times, larger pots here and there. And, you know, took cuttings as the years went on, and basically sprouted a flourishing jade plant arboretum and took over my living room for most winters. So
excellent.
The problem I have really specifically deals with, as the plant, let's call it the mother plant, got older, some of the stems, the trunks, whatever you want to call them, you know, as the plant got larger, it's probably about, you know, 3-4 foot in diameter. Some of the trunks and starting at the ends where the leaves and the branches were coming out, you know, the tips, they started to dry out. They started to shrivel up. And I noticed that the stems, the trunks, what have you, started to become sort of hollow and soft. And over time, they would dry out and basically, you know, with very little effort, just break off, revealing sort of a moldy.
Ah.
I don't know okay. If I want to use the term mold, but it smelled musty. Half the plant is still surviving and doing great.
Mm-hmm.
The other half of the plant has succumbed to this. I don't know if it's mold or rot, or you would probably, Mike, know way more about it than I would.
Oh, you're really close, man. There's a couple of things that can go wrong. If the plant doesn't get enough sun during the summertime when it's outside, it can get leggy and misshapen. If it's underwatered, it can start to get brown, dry spots on what we'll call the leaves, those, you know, those big fat things. If it gets overwatered, similar things can happen. But believe it or not, these plants, these jade plants that, you know, most people would put them in the bulletproof range, but they're really not. They require some care. They are prone to this disease. I'm not sure of the name, but when you said soft and rotten. That's an actual disease. And the biggest cause is lack of ventilation, lack of good airflow around the plant.
That's very interesting, something I never considered before.
And most people would not. Most people would not. That's why I get the big money here. You know, all you need, have you ever seen these little clip-on plastic fans that people take?
Sure.
Yeah. Just clip that on to some nearby area and just keep air moving across the plants. They will go nuts. Now, if you want to try to save mama, get rid of anything that is soft, because that's a sign that it's 44% dead. You know, find yourself some perlite. You'll never regret buying a small bag of it. It's totally organic. And really make that potting soil light. And if mama can be saved, fine. If not, there's always the children, which will, it sounds like now, with just this little added touch of good ventilation, you'll be able to grow to her size in a few years.
Yeah, Mike, thank you very much for the tips. I'll go out and get a fan, and hopefully that does the trick for me.
I think it will. It sounds like you're doing a lot of things right. All right, you take care, man.
Yeah, you too. Have a nice time in Cuba.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and start announcing where you can catch me live in this brave new year. On Monday, February 17th at 7 p.m., I'll return to the Upper Dublin Public Library in Fort Washington, PA, for a fundraiser for the Friends of the Upper Dublin Library, weather permitting, of course. And on Saturday, February 22nd, I'll appear at Green Spring Gardens in Alexandria, Virginia. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to get more berries on the thorn of fire. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Verbee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 70 new varieties for the 2014 growing season, including Steakhouse, a 3-pound-plus beefsteak tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at verbee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. Mike McGrath, I'm your host. Coming up later in the show, we'll be talking about pyracantha, the climbing plant, at least if you put it on a trellis, also known as firethorn, that produces all those beautiful red or orange berries that persist into the winter. We'll tell you how to maximize berry production after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Why, thank you.
Why, thank you, Jim. How are you, sir?
Pretty good.
And where is Jim pretty good?
I'm in Placerville, California. It's in the Sierra foothills, about halfway between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe, and about 8 miles away from the original gold finding in California, which started the gold rush.
Have you ever found any gold?
No.
You ever look?
I would be happy to grow squash.
Oh, okay. Golden squash, of course. All right, Jim, what can we do you for?
Yeah, we bought this property about 3 years ago. The previous owners left us a wonderful 3,500 square foot garden with deer fence and an orchard, and I've been trying to maintain it. The soil is acidic clay. It grows blueberries and strawberries well, and for everything else, I've had to put in lots of lime and oyster shells and stuff, and I've got the soil to about the correct pH and, you know, starting to be able to grow things. The problem I'm having, particularly with the squash, the plants will, you know, start out and grow lots of leaves and grow flowers, and then the flowers either just wither and die, or they start to form fruit, and then there's this sort of brown rot between the flower and the fruit. So I get lots and lots of leaves and not a lot of fruit, and it's a little frustrating.
Well, that's not an uncommon problem, especially early in the season. You say you're in the foothills of the Sierras. What does that mean? Are you at elevation? What kind of climate do you have?
We're at about 3,000 feet. We don't really get a lot of snow. We get some. And I sort of have the feeling that I'm close to having a very productive garden, but it's just not turning into fruits, you know, when I would expect that.
Now, we have a little surprise for you. We are calling somebody who's a specialist in high-altitude gardening. We're trying to get them on the line right now once we found out you were at elevation. How long have you been growing in this garden?
We bought the place about 3 years ago.
Okay.
And what I discovered, the soil was, again, clay and quite acid, so I've neutralized the acid. I do have lots of earthworms.
Good, good.
And lots of mycelium. We have a wonderful crop of porcini mushrooms in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something that seems to be good about the soil.
Right.
I think it's my own lack of competence that's the problem here.
How long of a growing season do you have typically?
We don't really get a hard frost until the end of November, so it's really pretty long.
Okay. It sounds like you got the same soil, same climate as I do. Now, when this and do you start to get summer squash towards the end of the season, or it's just a total failure all season long?
I have a greenhouse, so I start the plants early, and I get them in the ground, you know, in March, and they start to grow really well, and they flower, but they just don't make fruit, or they start to make fruit, and then it rots, dies.
Right. Well, if they didn't ever make fruit, then we would worry about your pollinators, but this is a condition that does affect summer squash. It's actually a true disease.
Really?
Yes, and it's in your soil. One of the things you want to do is you want to rotate your squash to a different area of the garden next season.
Okay.
You want to lighten up that soil as much as you can because, you know, clay is always our enemy. I would mix some perlite in there as you're doing that. I want you to move your squash around, and I want you to plant fewer plants per square foot.
Oh, okay.
The disease gets worse with crowding. Now we have a real treat for you. We have on the line, we have a guy named David Solomon. He is the chief horticulturalist at High Country Gardens, and he's familiar with your height, so to speak. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Mike. It's great to be on the show.
Well, thank you, and say hello to Jim.
Hey, Jim. How's it going out there on the left coast?
Not bad. It's very nice today.
And, David, have you heard our conversation so far?
Yes, I certainly have.
All right. What do you have to add, sir? Anything about his elevation that you want to give him some tips on?
Well, sounds like that, Jim, you have a wonderfully long growing season there. Is it high enough that you avoid the summer heat of the Central Valley, or do you get pretty hot summers there?
It goes into the 90s during the summer. So,
David,
yeah,
you know, summer squash, zucchini, that this is a real common crop. This is a real common problem. Do you think it is this kind of, quote, similar blossom end rot disease that's getting him because his soil is clay and maybe, like a lot of people, he's cramming too much into too small a spot?
Well, Mike, that could certainly be an issue. And then, Jim, I would certainly recommend, although it's, you say you've got a drip system, so that's good, because sometimes when you use a sprinkler, it can the splashing water can often transmit these bacterial diseases from plant to plant. So that might be, of course, you guys normally, I don't think, get a lot of summer moisture from the sky.
None.
If you have been using a sprinkler, you might want to just switch to drip and keep the foliage and flowers dry.
Right. I'm strictly drip.
Oh, that's okay. Well, then that's probably not an issue for you.
Right, but that's a good point, David. I mean, there's other people out there with this problem. When you use an overhead sprinkler and you get your plants wet, then you're just triple doomed.
I tend to be soft-hearted, and if the leaves wilt, I kind of want to give them more water. I'm moving back from watering every day to every other. What would be a sign of overwatering?
Well, interestingly, sometimes in the heat, if you water a lot, the plants get used to a very high water level, so in the soil. So if it gets unusually hot, you'll probably get some wilt just because the plants aren't able to bring the water out of the soil and transpire it through the leaves to cool themselves as adequately as they might when the temperatures are a little milder. I think your thought of cutting back on the frequency of the watering is a good one, because certainly in a heavier clay, every day watering might get it a little soggy, and then that might enhance the bacterial component of this end rot. So what I would suggest, Jim, is to mound up your hill to plant your squash on and mix in a lot of that good healing compost, and then water thoroughly, but every 2 to 3 days, and then the roots will go down into the clay only as far as they're comfortable with. But a nice mound of well aerated soil, I think, will help your problem.
And I'll go even further and suggest that you water really deeply for several hours at a pop early in the morning. No more than twice a week, but I want you to have a nice moisture-retaining mulch on the surface of the soil, because the symptoms of a plant that's overwatered are the same as a plant that's underwatered. Wilt will happen if a plant is getting too much water, and more plants are drowned by gardeners than are dehydrated.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think we got some good stuff. I think we're going to move these plants around. We're going to give them more airflow, give them more compost, and water deeply but infrequently. David Salmon, Chief Horticulturalist at High Country Gardens, thanks for coming on and help me out here.
Well, you bet, Mike. It's, I hope you guys get a little winter out there. I understand it's been more rain than snow.
It's been dry.
All right, guys.
Thanks so much.
All right, guys. Thanks for being on. Take care.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Patty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Patty. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I am doing just fine. Sitting up, taking nourishment. The doctor said it'll be better soon.
Uh-oh. I hope so.
Where's Patty? Great.
I'm just outside of Kennett Square, Pennsylvania.
Okay, home of mushroom soil and Longwood Gardens. That's a great dichotomy out there. All right, what can we do for Patty in Kennett Square?
Oh, I was just responding to an earlier show where you had a caller who was trying to get rid of some weeds in a shady area, and he was wondering what to plant there that would attract bees or butterflies. And I was just realizing that I have this euonymus that actually I have a few of them in the garden, and they, when they're flowering, they attract a huge number of insects. I mean, they are just swarming with insects, and I think some of them are bees. They look like little tiny bees, and some of them I think have stripes on them, but they're a lot smaller than honeybees.
Well, see, that, and that's, first of all, thank you. It is always great to add another plant to something that blooms in the shade. And as we know, most plants that produce flowers, if there's any pollen or nectar, there's bees that are going to find their way to them. But there's this misconception, I think, among the public that honeybees are native, that they're just everywhere. They are kind of everywhere, but that's because beekeeping is such a popular hobby among people. The only way you get an actual honeybee showing up at your plants is if somebody within, and a beekeeper would have to tell me how many miles or quarter miles or whatever, if there's a hive nearby, or, interestingly enough, if a queen has escaped from a hive and set up a rogue hive somewhere, like in a hollow tree, like they do back in their native Africa, and they're working out of that. Sometimes they also do that in the sides of houses. But most of the things we see coming to our flowers that we just think, and a lot of people think, oh my God, are these like bad insects? So many of them are native bees, and the diversity of native bees is just amazing. Last summer, I made a real important point. I told my wife I was going to start categorizing just our bumblebees, you know, the big ones, because they're obvious, and I like obvious stuff. I must have been able to pick out 10 different types of bumblebees. And what time of year does your Euonymus bloom?
Gosh, I think it's in the summer. It's a really big green one. It's about, I mean, it's like a dark green, and it's about 10 feet by 10 feet. Right now, it has red berries on it.
Okay, so obviously it got pollinated, right?
Yeah, so I can't remember exactly when it blooms. I think it's the summer.
That would typically be if the berries persist in the winter. So I will tell you that one thing I notice is no matter how early in the season it is, if I have something in bloom, I will see weird little bees. And some of them are very tiny, tiny black bees. Some of my favorites, and I've really haven't gone to the trouble to try to identify them, is they're golden bees, these long golden bees. And they're among the first ones out early in the season, and they're pollinating my pussy willow and my witch hazel.
Okay. Well, I really, I haven't looked closely, but I know there are a lot of different kinds of insects, and I think a lot of them are the native bees. It's obviously, it's very attractive to them.
Yeah, and good for you, because, it's almost like every bee is giving you more berries. And so thank you, and thank you for recognizing that these creatures visiting your plants were bees. I always worry that there's people who just jump for the raid anytime something other than them or the mailman comes walking into their garden. And a lot of times these native bees are really wild-looking, and we would never consider that they're bees, but they are absolutely essential for our plant health, for us to get food. And with honeybee colonies being devastated by disease the way they are, our native bees become more important every year.
Right. Well, the other thing is one of these bushes is by a path. It's very close to the path. And I've noticed that I can walk by it and just, you know, almost walk through this swarm of insects, and they're not aggressive at all. So, you know, they're really not a problem.
I've really never been able to confirm anyone ever being stung by a native bee. And all the native bees in America, I believe, none of the males have stingers. You know, Mother Nature knew not to give guns to the men. And the females do have stingers, but being females, they just don't use them. And I've talked to researchers who say they've often plucked these bees out of the air to examine them to see if they're male or female. And they can see the female with the stinger, but they still don't get stung. You know, 20, 30, 40 years of working with these creatures. And I've certainly never been stung by anything that wasn't a wasp or a yellow jacket. All right, Patty, thank you so much for adding another plant to our shade garden bee and butterfly attractor list.
All right, well, thank you, Mike. I listen every week.
Well, thank you so much. You take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners who had a cut Christmas tree in the house to be sure and recycle that tannenbaum, but not in the compost pile. Prune off entire branches and use them as springy protection for pansies and other winter plants. Or fill the tree with suet feeders and globs of peanut butter to make the ultimate natural backyard feeder. Or find a recycling location that will use it to help make an artificial reef somewhere. Just don't go repurposing your pine just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to get more berries on the fabulous perennial known as Pyracantha. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 70 new varieties for the 2014 growing season, including Steakhouse, a 3-pound plus beefsteak tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, it'll be time for the question of the week, focusing on the plant known as Pyracantha or firethorn. What do you do to get the maximum amount of those beautiful fall and winter berries? We will tell you right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Rick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, thank you for being had, Rick. Where are you?
I'm in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Rick in Lincoln?
So, Mike, I called up I emailed about a month ago because I heard on your talk show a lady called in and had some questions about genetically modified corn and wondered if there was evidence to suggest that GM corn was as good as or was less safe than some of the organic pesticides that are being used on crops today.
Right. She was concerned, I think, specifically. I think genetically modified corn may be multiply genetified, so to speak. But the thing she was most concerned about was the natural organic pesticide, BT, being engineered into the corn. People who eat non-organic corn or non-GMO corn are actually eating BT, which we humans really haven't done before. And she was concerned about that.
Yeah, so I thought I would maybe make some suggestions about some of the answers that you gave or just the sort of misunderstanding people have about the genetically modified crops that are on the marketplace today, if I may.
Sure. Do you have a dog in this fight, Rick? Or are you?
I've been working on GM safety since 1997. And in 1997, I worked at Monsanto until 2004. And I worked as a regulatory scientist there on the safety of GM crops. So there are various microbial pesticides called BT, which is really the short term for Bacillus thuringiensis, a common soil bacteria. But formulations such as those by Dipol have actually been using whole bacteria that have been genetically changed in a way so that they don't include some of the other toxins that are found in some of the more common wild or native soil bacteria. When we talk about BT corn, in that case, one single gene has been taken from Bacillus thuringiensis, the bacteria, and spliced into the chromosomes of the plant, of the corn.
Right, and I'll explain because corn is attacked by a bunch of caterpillar pests.
Oh, it is, yeah.
The root worm, the ear worm, any non-worm that actually has the word worm in it, any agricultural pest is actually a caterpillar. And in the old days, people would spray BT on the corn, and then any caterpillar that ate the sprayed part of the corn would die without any harm to the surroundings. First of all, we should alert listeners that gardeners, home gardeners, do not have access to genetically modified seeds or plants. That is commercial only. So you don't have to worry about any of the seed companies sending you GM plants or seeds or anything like that. And you're saying something, you know, because this is not my table, obviously,
since
home gardeners can't use GM crops, we don't talk about it much. Although I will tell you it is the single biggest topic people want us to talk about more. So your point is you feel the BT that's used in that part of a genetically modified corn plant is very safe.
I do. I think that and you can find good documentation. I think I have a list of over 400 publications that look at safety, both environmental and mammalian safety, so using in food or feed BTs and herbicide-tolerant traits as well. There's a lot of testing that is done.
Well, with any influence you have as a former worker in the industry and now a scientist in it, I can tell you that my main concern is the overuse of Roundup, which I believe has negative effects on amphibians, which are very important for natural pest control. And I don't like the idea of us eating Roundup because, as you know, Roundup is a systemic herbicide. Not only is it in the plant to begin with, but when you spray it on the ground around a plant to kill broadleaf weeds, the plant takes it up. So everybody who's eaten corn chips and corn flakes that are made with, quote, conventional corn is eating herbicide. And I realize, you know, we've been eating herbicide for a long time. But that's the part that I would love to see the industry back off on. That would relax me quite a bit.
So, and Mike, you have a very important point that the farmers have to use whatever pesticides, which you could say insecticides or herbicides, that they're using. They have to use them under the guidelines that are set up for the use of that particular product. And so just as in any other pesticide, there are guidelines about when you can apply glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And there have been residue studies performed to look at the breakdown of glyphosate, what it breaks down to, are there toxic properties with that. And actually, the glyphosate is broken down fairly quickly, and studies have been done on the metabolites that are coming out of that breakdown. So the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture are all involved in looking at those. I agree with you 100% that we don't want to overuse chemicals that can cause some accumulation or harm in the environment. And so that's, I think, an important thing for the farmers to keep in mind and for the companies.
All right. Well, I think that's a good spot to end. Let's all work for less rather than more.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mike, for the opportunity to be on your show. I really enjoy hearing it.
All right, good. Thank you, Rick. Take care.
Yep, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ben, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing okay, Ben. How are you?
Good, very good. I'm in Yardley, PA.
Okay. What can we do for Ben in Yardley?
So I was calling because my wife and I are renovating our kitchen, and we are planning to build 4 raised bed gardens directly behind our kitchen, which is very convenient as far as, you know, getting to it and everything. The only problem is we have a very shady lot, and so I was trying to figure out the space that we're putting these gardens, there's really no direct sun. And I was trying to figure out if there's any way to redirect sunlight. So I did some researching online and found something called a heliostat, which is essentially a mirror that tracks the sun throughout the day and redirects the sunlight. And I was curious if you had any experience with that, if that's an effective way to actually get sun to the garden, or if I'm just sort of out of luck here.
Wow. So this is like that old thing on Mythbusters where Alexander the Great used a mirror to like burst the enemy ships into flame, right?
Yeah. Yes, except I'm just gardening, that's all.
Well, so far, that's what you think. You got the washout on the line, and all of a sudden we got, jeans and T-shirts up in flames, you know, and the volunteer fire company coming by and people getting all excited. A heliostat, helio for the sun, and stat, for stat. So is it powered by sunlight? What moves the mirror?
That's a very good question. I believe that it is powered by the sun, that it's, you know, it's solar powered, and it's essentially just you put it in the lawn about 30 feet away from wherever you're trying to direct the sunlight, or at least a maximum of that distance, and it follows the path of the sun, redirecting it. You show it where you want it to, where you want the light to go, and it follows that path throughout the day, or at least as long as the sun is hitting it.
Well, that's really interesting because that's what a sunflower does. The big oil head sunflowers, they actually turn as the sun moves in the sky to keep getting the sun in their face, the opposite of what human drivers do. How big is this sucker?
It looked to me from the website, it was, maybe about 2 to 3 feet diameter. Mm-hmm. And it looks, it's on a pole and it looks, it's a bunch of mirrors that are shaped like a sunflower.
And does it tell you how big an area it will illuminate?
I'm not sure. That was one of my questions, though, because obviously if we have 4 raised bed gardens, we're trying to, that's sort of a big area. So I didn't know if maybe, we put it farther away, it's going to, the sunlight would diffuse or spread out a little bit. But also, maybe you get less of that light, less of the benefit of the light when it's farther away.
And if you put it too close, your zucchini will burst into flame, man. I haven't heard of anything like this, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work. Do you have any areas on your property that might make you walk a little further, but get real sunlight?
Not really.
in theory, reflected light has been used to augment the sunlight that goes into a garden. I've not heard of it being used like this, but if you're game for it, man, go for it. And you just simply have to promise to call us back after a season and tell us what you think.
Let you know how it goes. Okay, well, our gardening experience is fairly minimal, so pretty much anything that grows will feel like a success to us.
Well,
so
then it's very important you follow my old school caveat, which is if you can't give your plants enough sun, make sure you give them everything else. Make sure those beds are nice and raised. Make sure their soil is light and fluffy and you never step in it. Don't water overhead. Don't overwater. Don't overfeed till you see what's going on. And then the sign of too little light is leggy plants, plants that are tall and spindly.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
okay.
So you know, if you do this, you got to send us a picture, first of all, and then you got to tell us what happens at the end of next season.
All right, will do. I will do a field test and let you know how it works out.
Excellent, excellent. We'll be here.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Ben. Take care. Good luck, man.
Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Pyracantha, getting more berries on your firethorn. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden. Read us this week's question, please.
Sure, Mike. We heard from Adrian in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, who writes, how and when should I prune my pyracanthus to get more red berries? They get good sun, but I see that other people's plants have more berries.
Ha! Another case of winter berry envy. Pyracantha may be better known to some people under its common name of firethorn. I see a lot of espaliered specimens in Center City, Philly, that are loaded with berries in the fall. They're generally orange as opposed to red.
I know the plant you're talking about. Some old houses on Pine Street are covered with the berries. Can you help Adrian get more?
Well, the basics for getting lots of berries in general are good sun, good pollination, and knowing when and if to prune. But the age of the plant also matters, as do ill-advised food and mulch. So I asked Adrian for some details.
Yeah, you sent him like a dozen questions. He responds, I have them espaliered with lattice work. They get sun from early morning to about 3 in the afternoon. They are not mulched nor fed. I did prune off the back branches so I could espalier them. They are not crowded. It will take a few years for that to happen as they are not old. I planted one about 3 years ago but had to move it to a sunnier spot. That's when I built the trellises. It has done well, is now about 4 feet tall, and has very pretty red berries. 2 months ago, I bought 3 more. They are about 2 feet tall and are doing well. I'm away all summer, so I have no interest in the flowers. But I am here all winter, and you are correct. I want lots of berries. I once saw pyros that had berries everywhere on a garden tour, a whole wall of them. Unfortunately, I did not ask the owner how he got them so full.
You done? Geez, I'm glad we're not paying you by the word. Now, not only are the flowers of firethorn what we call insignificant, they're also stinky, so Adrian's not missing any summer fun. Everybody who grows these plants does so for the colorful berries, which make great holiday decorations and excellent natural food for birds, especially cedar waxwings.
Okay, so how does he make more bird food?
Cute. Now, it sounds like the plants have good sun, and Adrian doesn't seem to be causing any problems with mulch or food. So I think the immediate cause of his envy is just impatience. Most of his plants are brand new, and long-lived perennials typically take a couple of years to achieve the kind of biomass that allows them to really put on a show. Plus, his very first words were, "How do I prune them?" Which leads me to believe he has pruning spielkes and probably can't leave the poor plants alone. Too much pruning or random, uninformed pruning is always a bad idea, especially with plants like these that bloom on old wood.
Like?
You say what you're thinking and I'll key your car. Now, as Lee Reich explains in his classic The Pruning Book,
I was wondering how long it would take for your friend Lee Reich to be the one to actually answer this question, like so many others we get.
Hey, watch it. I know where you parked your car. But yes, Lee is my go-to pruning guy. He says that without proper care, the interiors of these plants are going to become crowded, which will reduce flowering and berry production. But the timing and technique of keeping them open are very important because, once again, these plants bloom on old wood, not new wood.
Now it sounds really complicated.
And that's why I get the big money. Anyway, my suggestion would have been to let the plants grow and mature for a couple of years.
And then start pruning?
Right. But Lee says to start pruning right away while the plants are still young, shortening all the, quote, secondary branches, the ones that aren't creating the main espalier pattern, to about 5 inches in length in late spring. Then he says to shorten those previously shortened branches again, down to about 2 inches long the following winter, to, quote, maintain a neat tracery of branches clothed in tight clusters of berries. Especially, you don't want any, quote, wayward stems escaping their espalier.
And for our listeners who may not know what espalier specifically means?
Up against a wall. Which is almost the exact same words Grace Slick once used.
When she threw a bottle of Chivas Regal at your head?
No. She did that about 8 years later. I told you that story?
And several others about your rock and roll escapades in the early 1970s, like when you threatened Ray Davies of the Kinks after a show and actually got into a fight with John Lennon.
He started it. Well, that sure was some interesting information about boosting your berry bonanza, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to take down my trellis if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden. Sure, at garden@whyy.org.
Please tell us where you live when you email us. Please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm full of berries, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Those little white balls in your potting soil aren't plastic, they're perlite. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to use this priceless but inexpensive organic amendment. Plus your fabulous phone calls.